Well, let's talk about the life of Graham Greene. I was somewhat intimidated when I first saw the book, and it's not even finished yet. But I didn't know very much about Graham Greene. I'd read some of his major books, but I really didn't know very much about his life. I should have. I did have both of his volumes of autobiography, which, until I read this, I had not read. And this inspired me to I've read the first volume and part of the second volume. In a way, I deliberately, I stopped at the second volume approximately where you stopped. So I still have some surprises.
Okay, in Ways of Escape.
Ways of Escape, that's the second one, right?
Yes.
Which is, and so we stop approximately 1941 or so, right? I stopped. No, I guess that one. I get a little further. I guess it, he went a little further. I think he.
I'm writing now about the Blitz.
Yeah, he
that's what you're up to, Don.
He did go into the army, didn't he? Was it the army?
Intelligence.
Intelligence. That's right. Intelligence. I'm right about
MI5
that.
MI5.
Yeah, I'm just about at that phase.
Kim Philby and the traitor and all that.
Yeah.
Whom I corresponded with, I may tell you. He was then alive and in Moscow, and Graham gave me his address. And he said, now look, Norman, there's no question that if you send a letter to Kim Philby, the greatest traitor Britain has ever had, they're going to pick you up. They're going to watch your letters. They're going to, you're going to be under surveillance and so on. And so he then got someone to write in to say, look, Norman Sherry was not a traitor. He was writing to this traitor for special reasons and so on. And we carried on quite a correspondence, Kim Philby and I. In fact, Philby, once I'd got the information, wanted to go on. He clearly wanted contact. And for me, it was a difficult situation, in the sense that his letters clearly would be of very great value, but I had been told by various secret agents, intelligence people in England, that he had led to the death of many, many of their agents, Philby's betrayal. And so I didn't reply to him, but he even got interested in Conrad, and whom I'd written most of my books about.
Well, Philby will make an appearance in the second volume, is that correct?
He will. I'm coming up to the man now.
You're in the process of writing it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, you have we have two interesting stories. We have the story of Graham Greene, and it's also interesting how you began this project. How did it happen that you, in effect, got the blessing of Graham Greene to write this book? How did this come about?
Maybe, Don, because I didn't seek it. By that time, I had discovered, or at least once I got into his letters, I discovered, at least six major biographers had approached the great master of English literature, the living today, the grand old man of English literature. And he had turned them all down. And I remember one letter written to his brother, a chap who used to run the BBC, called Hugh Greene, Sir Hugh Greene. And he said, dear Hugh, I'm appalled at the idea that you should suggest yet another person to be my biographer. I do not want anyone creeping over my life, walking over my personality. And therefore, why and how did it happen? Since he has this great reluctance to reveal anything, such as his reticence, such as his the sense of the man as a private individual. Why and how, then, did Norman Sherry become his biographer? I think it was just at the time that Evelyn Waugh's biography had been published, written by a friend of Waugh's called Christopher Sykes, now dead. Sykes had really scored off him, knew his background, scored off his own friend, getting, in a sense, you would perhaps might think, his own back, even though his friend was now dead, getting his own back for various slights and whatever. So Greene, therefore, decided, sooner or later, facts of a person's life, especially scandal, or scandalous, or slightly risky, whatever, in a man's life, all sinners, after all, it'll get out. Sooner or later, there's nothing that you can think of in literature that hasn't come out. I'm thinking of Dickens living with his incredibly young actress. That didn't come out with the biographer, but it came out. Charlotte Bronte falling in love with another woman's husband, Professor Eger, that was brought out ultimately by the family, but yet kept dark by the biographer. So things will come out. Greene knew that. And he knows also that many writers, biographers of a certain kind and kidney, you know them yourself, in this town, certain people have been maligned by such people, I don't want to mention names, but that there is a thing called a gutter press, that the people come out of the woodwork and will write and will be muckraking, seeking dirt, digging dirt. So he decided, before that could happen, that he'd choose a biographer that he admired. It turned out quite accidentally to be myself. Most of all, I think, because of Joseph Conrad. Conrad was one, for Green, one of the truly great writers. And whilst I had no idea that when I was working on Conrad, Green was at a distance, sizing me up and trying to judge me. But that's what he was doing. Indeed, I remember the occasion, 1971. I brought out what I thought then was my best book. Do I still think? No, I think this is now. But I certainly thought that was then, Conrad's Western World. And it didn't sell so well, and I was awfully disappointed. And at the end of the year, Graham Greene chose it as his book of the year in the Observer newspaper. And whoosh, the sales suddenly took off, simply because Greene had said a few wonderful words about it. So even then, he was, as it were, looking in my direction without my knowledge. And it was purely accident that I went one day to Beaverbrook Library. I was taken there by a famous historian called A.G.P. Taylor. And I went there to look at a Conrad letter, which I'd never seen, which was, in fact, about America, where he's talking about the great unfenced country. And the deputy librarian came up to me, a man called Bill Igo, funny name, I-G-O-E, strong Catholic, used to write articles for the Catholic newspaper, The Tablet, the British Catholic newspaper. And he came up to me, he said, "Professor Sherry," he said, "would you like to have lunch with me?" I didn't know him from Adam. And we went out and we went where journalists drink. And it seemed to me they drank even more than they write. That's what I remember by the afternoon. Everybody seemed to be drinking then. And we're having a ploughman's lunch. And then he said, he uttered the pregnant words and said, "There's a man who is a legend in his own time who admires your work, Professor Sherry." And I said, "Legends fascinate. Who?" And he said, "Graham Greene." And so it was arranged that I met, and we met at my London club, which goes back a couple of hundred years, where Robert Louis Stevenson was a member. Henry James, the American writer, was also a member. Stevenson being a cousin of Graham Greene, so there's the author of Treasure Island, whatever, there's a tradition all of its own there. And Greene turned up looking awfully young, I remember. And the very first words he asked me were, "I hope you're not a Catholic." He didn't want a Catholic. He didn't want a friend. He wanted a true outsider to write it. Perhaps because it would take that person a long time to really get to know. Because it would be as if there was only a single patch of light in a great sea of darkness. And that's what I had to overcome. And that, of course, is why the book has taken so long. And why it was necessary to do all the journeys that I needed to do. And that was the third thing he said. "I'd like someone who might understand some of the journeys I have made." And you know, Greene could have been a fantastic explorer, because he took journeys that no other man had taken. And why did he do it? Why was he always testing himself? It was a question I was constantly asking. And I did those journeys and tested myself, but became much more ill than Graham Greene, alas, in doing.
Well, I want to get to that, but let's go back at this club. You said he didn't want one who is a Catholic. Now, you write in the life of Graham Greene that Graham Greene converted to Catholicism for the wrong reason, because of his love for the woman that he married. But why at this point would he object to a Catholic?
I think, in a curious kind of way, he wanted someone who would have no presuppositions. In fact, having said, I said to him, "Well, I was baptized a Catholic. I may be a little lapsed, but I mean, I'm baptized." He wasn't too happy about that, I remember. But what he was fascinated about, what he wanted, and he wrote to me when I was in Liberia, to the University of Sierra Leone, the next state there. He wrote, I remember, in one of his books which he sent me, and he wrote, "To my doppelganger."
Mm-hmm.
So that already, as it were, he was living again through my experience, and always got awfully excited by my accounts of what it was like covering the same ground as he had once covered. And roared compulsively when I got dysentery in exactly the same mountain village as he had got it in 40 years before.
Now, where is Greene living now?
Greene has lived these 20 years in the south of France, in Antibes.
So you visited him there? And
I visited him there, that's true. But also, he often would come to England and stay at his sister's place, his sister being his secretary, Very curious thing. When you get a letter from Graham Greene, if it's a personal letter, it'll be written in his own hand, it'll come from the south of France, from Antibes. If you get a letter that comes from south of England, then you know what's really happened, is that he's spoken through his dictaphone, sent the tapes off to his sister. Sister then types the letter, and he will, when he called there, have signed, you know, a thousand copies with his name, Graham Greene, or Graham, or affectionately, or, you know, love, whoever, or yours sincerely, or even faithfully, damn it, depending on who he's writing to. So that you get, it looks like a private letter, but in fact isn't. So you'd often go there, and that's where we often met.
Now, where are most of his records, letters?
His records are, there's some in Fleet Street, down in the in a bank there, all the letters that he wrote to his mother. He wrote letters all his life to his mother. His mother looked upon him as a very strange little boy who wanted to commit suicide, but also had the qualities of genius about him. And she kept his letters from the age of 14. So we've got a tremendous catch of letters there. Other letters, the love letters, which I think is one of the most wonderful love stories of our century, which I was able to write about when he fell so desperately in love with Vivian Darrell Browning, such that he wrote in a mere 30 months 2,000 letters. Was there ever anyone who wrote so many letters? Letters and cards and telegrams. Telegrams in those days, of course, would get there very quickly, as indeed would letters. So you'd see him writing to his girlfriend one day, and he's getting a reply back the same day, and he's writing only the next day in reply to that letter. So things were moving very fast then, it seems, not so old-fashioned at all.
So you had many interviews with Greene as well.
I had. Greene, you understand, first was reticent. Second, very shy. Sometimes he was overcome by the fact that I would be, as he calls it, grilling me, Norman. He didn't want that to happen. He would constantly ask me to come loaded, and I came loaded with hundreds of questions, and he would answer right off the top of his head very quickly. When I came to a question that disturbed him, his blue eyes would smoke, and he would say, "I don't think I will answer that." He never lied. That's a curious thing about him. He would often tell a story against himself, but he often wouldn't tell me. And then, of course, that's where my literary detective work comes in. So if I wanted to know, as I had to know, about why this young boy at the age of 13 wanted to commit suicide so often and in so many different ways, I had to know about that. This was when he was at school at Berkhamsted.
Yes, you were father was way headmaster. Back talking to his associates, for example, at the public school he attended. You even checked out his nemesis, I think, a man named Carter?
A man named Carter.
And we didn't talk to him. I guess he was dead.
Couldn't talk to him, but I should have done so.
Struck his wife.
I found his wife, an aged old lady down in the south of England near Brighton. I found, you know, he had a breakdown as a youngster because of this, of being bullied as a youngster at school and trying to commit suicide and ultimately running away. And so his father sent him to a psychiatrist. Not a psychiatrist, as you probably know, not the kind of psychiatrist you and I would go to, because he was totally unqualified and awfully strange and an alcoholic to boot. But nevertheless, it was one of truly great experience meeting that man. And he fell in love with the man's wife, Zoe Richmond, they called her. And I tracked her down. I was sure she'd be dead, but she was not. She was 96 when I met her and lived almost to 100. So ultimately, it seems to me, that if you've got a reticent person, and even if you did not have, is if you've got a person who's willing to tell all, he's telling all from his perspective, and that may not necessarily be the truth. It'll only be a segment of the truth. If you want the total truth, if that's ever possible, then you must surely go back to look for people who were around at that particular moment in time.
And in fact, his own two volumes of autobiography were probably helpful from to establish chronology, although you point out that there were errors in it. But autobiography is usually self-serving. I was talking to Arnold Rampersad, who wrote a two-volume biography of Langston Hughes, and Hughes himself had written two volumes of autobiography, and Rampersad told me that the books were lies, that Hughes made up people, changed dates, created episodes that didn't exist. So autobiography is... well, self-serving to a degree. It takes a biographer such as yourself to try to get all the facts and put them in perspective. However, speaking of biography, I was reading recently, there's a new biography of Faulkner, which has new information about it. And I believe an earlier two-volume biography of Faulkner, which was at that time considered the epitome, didn't really contain everything needed to know about Faulkner because the biographer was so close to Faulkner that he left certain things out that might have embarrassed the family.
That's true of Dickens, of course, the great biographer of Dickens. It's a wonderful biography still, and perhaps the greatest biographer of Victorian times, written by Mrs. Gaskell about Charlotte Bronte. She also, because of their closeness, was quite reticent about certain facts. It's perfectly true, though. Blotner's book seems to me very good. You're talking about Frederick Carl. He took 3.5 years to write that book. It took me 3.5 years to write a single chapter there because I wanted always to find out more material and to have constantly different notions and attitudes about the man. And so what I did, I went to the school, and I've got the names of his schoolboys, because this is where he tried to commit suicide. And, of course, at first nobody would speak, and finally I tracked these old boys down in Spain, in Brazil, in Portugal, in England, of course. Many of them had died. And such is the short duration of human beings. You know, we come like water, we go like wind. Hardly a moment goes without people dying. And so those 30 people that I tracked down, old boys, all willing to speak, of course, about Graham, and especially about the father, the headmaster of the school, only three are now alive. And I got a letter from one of those three just the other day. He had read the book in England, because it came out in April in England, and he wrote to me and he said, "I don't know how you've done it, Professor Sherry, but you have taken me back to my school days almost more intimately than I can recall them, because you've collected so much information about so many things that were going on at that time. You have made me live again things that had gone and been lost and forgotten." Because what I'm so often trying to do is not only deal with Graham Greene, but to try to present a kind of phase, a total recall of all sorts of events and incidents that took place long ago.
And that's right. You have to put your character in the perspective of his time.
Yes, yes. You have to do that for a very special reason, it seems to me. And my reason is this. I was born of very old parents, 56-year-old 57-year-old father, a 48-year-old mother. And they died long ago. And so I've been excessively conscious of death and of the way in which the very thing that is happening to us now, that we've been trying to meet all day, and ultimately we have. I was in the future until we met. Now I'm in the present. And very soon, such is the nature of time, that our present presence is going to go into the past. We're going to plunge into the past. All incidents are not only human beings, but incidents are constantly dying. And what I feel I'm doing is a kind of antidote to death, to bring back into existence those lost, forgotten people who have been related to Graham Greene. And notice and remember that this man, straddling the century as he does from 1904, you know, damn it, only 3 years after the death of Victoria, who was born, and is still with us. Only the other day writing to me to say he's involved in yet another book. Is still writing and has been involved in some of the major conflicts of our age, and has always been that kind of creature that was dicing with death, going towards trouble. A most remarkable man for a person who had been bullied and humiliated and felt somewhat cowardly. How he overcame that cowardice and became, in some ways, one of the giants of our time.
He did have literary pretensions at an early age. At Oxford, he was writing, and had you have some excerpts, photocopies, I guess, of his earliest work. Of course, he did become a journalist. So I guess his desire to become a writer started fairly early, didn't it?
I think so. But of course, he did put around to his parents that he wanted to be a businessman. He never wanted to be a writer. He was constantly disguising himself. And what I had to do was to get beyond that particular disguise. When I first met him, Don, I remember him saying to me, in a pub that he took me to, where he used to drink with the traitor Kim Philby, I remember him saying to me when I asked him, are you still a Catholic? And don't forget, this is the great convert. And he said, probably not. And I said, why did you become a writer? These were stupid, early questions that one would ask because I knew so little. And he said, well, seemed nothing much else that I could do, so I did it. I don't know. It's too late to start again. Both those answers seemed to me to be absolute poppycock and balderdash.
You're right, because as you point out in the biography, he struggled. He had an initial success with his first book, the title of which escapes me.
Man Within.
And that's right, The Man Within.
Not a good title. He's very good at titles. Think of our third man.
His next two books were failures. The nonfiction book, a biography,
Lord Rochester.
That might have convinced anybody to... Of course, if you've had initial success with that first book, Man Within, even though you've had two lesser books, that's really not enough to stop you, though, is it?
I think he felt he couldn't stop, of course. I think humiliation is something that he has to fight and always does fight. Being a very, very shy, sensitive person. I think what the book does do, at least I hope this is what it does do, not only does it tell you about his life, not only about his love life, the early passionate, romantic young man that he was, but it tells you also how he went about learning to write. So that if you can't write, or if you can write as badly as times as Graham Greene did in the early days, one of the worst stories I've ever read, you would have to be daft and dumb and blind and a positive, dare I say it, a positive moron to write as badly as he wrote in a story called Murder for the Wrong Reasons. And yet he is today one of the truly great writers of our time. What journey did he take? What kind of discipline was demanded? What kind of expenses did he have? Because, you know, he's always, I said, going dicing with death, but he's going towards his material. He's seeking out extreme situations which he can dramatize and write about, as he was doing when he went to Mexico. You notice he went there because of the persecution of the Catholics, because priests, there's a photograph of a priest in the book who has just been hanged. The persecution was very serious, that if you were a priest, you were likely... The decree was that you had to marry. And if you didn't marry, and how could a Roman Catholic priest marry, then they were going to shoot you if they found you. And if you carried on your job as a priest, performing your work as your vocation, then if they found you, they would shoot you. And what they did to the whiskey priest, as I discovered, the original source for the story in The Power and the Glory, surely one of his truly great novels, what they did when they finally found him was to kill that whiskey priest, the original, with machetes, and then they fed him to pigs so that his body, so he would have no Catholic influence again, so his body would disappear and he would disappear. And it was incredible finding that out, since even leading people, Catholics in Washington, who had been historians and had some inside information about him, never knew what happened to him until I went to Mexico and ultimately unearthed the sleuthed the thing, because in a way also the thing I'm trying to do is to become a kind of Sherlock Holmes of literature. So I'm finding things out that have been lost and forgotten or hidden and cannot be found out, whether it's because institutions don't wish it to be known or whether it's because the writer doesn't wish it to be known.
Did you, like Greene, travel 3 days in the hills on a mule?
I've got to tell you the truth, Don. I have a photograph of me on a mule, which I sent to Graham Greene. And I said, look, you see, I'm climbing the hills as you climbed them 40 years ago. And but I didn't go too far. I stuck it out for a day and a night, and I had it difficult to sit down.
You could get on the mule for just to have the picture taken and then get right off again and say, look, Graham, you can see I did the same thing. He doesn't have to know.
Well, I didn't do it for long. It's perfectly true. But I did try it because I wanted to know the experience. And I've never been so exhausted in all my life.
He obviously, as you point out, he despised Mexico. It was a wretched journey, wretched odyssey there. Has Mexico changed? Is it better for you?
You see, the great thing is, obviously, supposing I was going to go to Saigon now because of the famous novel that he wrote called The Quiet American, I couldn't get in. That was the very first thing he said to me, obviously hoping that I'd do the journeys that he had done. You couldn't do what you'd done for Conrad, because I followed Conrad around, the famous Polish-English novelist. Because you couldn't get into Saigon because communists have taken it over. If a country has been modernized terrifically, like Singapore today, If Green had been there, it would have changed out of all recognition. You have to go, surprisingly enough, in order to study what Yeats calls the rag and bone shop of the heart. You have to go to seedy Greenland, and that is places like Liberia and Sierra Leone that have not changed one iota. They are exactly the same, if not a little seedier. And, of course, you run into all sorts of corruptions and troubles and tribulations when you go to these countries.
Yeah, I have a feeling that Mexico and the state of Tabasco probably has not changed that much since...
It's changed somewhat there. But what had not changed was I was able to collect oral history from people. If you go right up in the mountains, people have moved. You know, just as in England, quite often, I know a shopkeeper whose family had been in that shop for 150 years. Still selling and doing the same things, still selling cigarettes and what have you, a tobacconist. It hasn't changed. Likewise, up in the mountains of Chiapas, the 40 years was as nothing. That he had been there, dear me, I was quite certain I'd been bitten by the same fleas, and I certainly saw these massive rats swarming up the walls. And in order not to be bitten, I'd got into my own special sleeping bag, and then put it inside the bed. But still, it's impossible in such places. Things constantly happen.
As you wrote the life of Graham Greene, did you give him the manuscript to check for accuracy or
now,
for
this,
any revisions?
This you might think, that since he had chosen his biographer, in spite of the fact he was appalled by the whole notion of anyone working over his life, that he would be out to control his biographer. He was not. He did not. He said to me once, "I hope to read your book, Norman, on my deathbed." Meaning, of course, that he wasn't going to read it. I think he thought, "What on earth is Sherry up to?" I heard stories that he was thinking, "Is that man never going to finish the book?" and so on. But of course, he did not know that I was trying to seek secrets that he was not going to tell his biographer, and that he would take down into the grave. And what I was trying to do was to let in light, was to bring them out, to keep them above the surface. Not only by seeking Graham Greene out, by seeking his friends, and indeed seeking out his enemies. I remember one day walking with him across Berkhamsted Common, and he suddenly turned on me. And this was in the early days, and he said, "Norman, I've sent you to different friends of mine to get your own private opinion of them." And he said, "Every time, I've been told, he said, every time, just before you leave, you ask, 'Can you give me the name of an enemy of Graham Greene, please?'" And your mind works very quickly then, and I thought, "My God, should I lie? Should I lie and say no?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, quickly, I said, "Can it be the case, Graham, the man who has been successful as you have been successful is devoid of enemies? Because what you're asking for is for human beings not to be human. The bare-forked animal is constantly jealous and envious. These are some of the most powerful emotions. So there must be enemies." And I said, "I'm sick and tired of the saccharine accounts that I've been getting from your friends. No one can write a biography with such material." "Oh," he said, "nothing further. After all my expatiations, nothing further. Just, oh." And then we got back to the Ritz Hotel late that night. And his brother, Sir Hugh Greene, now dead, alas, who had been Director General of the BBC, great, big, powerful, shambling man, 6'4". I remember his feet over the edge of the bed. He was lying down in the bed. And Graham was looking in the mirror, and he was shaving. And he stared in the mirror. I was to the right, like some narrator figure, just listening to this. And he was looking in the mirror as he was shaving and looking at his brother, Hugh, that great, powerful body. And he said to him, "Hugh, Norman wants the name of enemies. Now, what's the name of that chap that hated me so much in Sierra Leone when I was in intelligence there?" And quickly, quite quickly, both of them suddenly welcomed me with a list of names. And so I had the enemies, and of course I've spoken to some of them since, no question about it, as is necessary to get the full picture, because one is after the truth. And so Greene has never interfered with the truth.
Now you believe...
He never saw the book until it was too late to change it.
Now you believe he has read it now, though?
I know he has read it now. Mm-hmm. And why and how? Because in his last letter to me, he wrote in this way. Don't forget, he always ends his letters with the words, "Affectionately, Graham." This time he wrote at the end of the last letter to me, "Yours still in affection, Dash." Dash, is that what you call it?
Yes.
Dash. In spite of all. And I took that to mean that, and as I've heard from other sources, that he'd been much impressed by the book and somewhat discomposed by the fact that I've collected secrets that he did not know how I could collect. That he's admired the book, admired indeed its literary detection. He said you can read it so quickly, in spite of its size. You can read it as easily as a detective thriller, is what he said. But he knows it had to be done. Otherwise some muckraker would come out of the woodwork and dig the dirt. And you better get it right. And that's what he's looking for. He will not find it easy to live with it, but he felt it had to be done.
Well, Norman, sure, to kind of wrap things up, Graham Greene, where does he stand in relation to the other great modern writers of the 20th century?
Don, could you mention some of them? You're thinking of whom in particular? Who would you mention?
Well,
Joseph Conrad, Henry James.
Certainly Conrad. We can speak about... Fitzgerald,
Ernest Hemingway.
Hemingway, Doris Lessing.
Doris Lessing.
I mean, on and on and on.
Yes, all right. I think...
Somebody some time ago asked me the name of my favorite television news correspondent, and I had a complete mental blank. Couldn't think of anybody.
Okay. Well,
I thought, well, may I say there's Mike Wallace. Let's see, who else is there? I can't think of any other names. But, you know, the top rank of writers who are... These are writers who are read around the world, and their works have been translated, and... Certainly Greene meets that criteria.
Yes. Graham would certainly say, has said to me, in fact, I'm only of the second class, that I'm not in the class of Dickens or Balzac or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky and so on. I was somewhat troubled when I first decided that I would be his biographer, indeed before I made that decision. The agent, my literary agent, said, "Good Lord, Norman, this is the biography to do. This is the man who's lived and seen everything and done everything. This has to be the life to do if you can." And it was looked upon by many people as the most fascinating life of the 20th century. And I took away with me, I was not at all certain, that I could afford to spend, I thought then, only 10 years of my life to write the life of Graham Greene. That's an awful expenditure of time, of one's life, as it's dripping away. And I took away two books. One was The Ministry of Fear, a thriller set in London, which Graham Greene wrote, and which I discovered to be absolutely brilliant. And I took away also The Power and the Glory, that I look upon as his great masterpiece now. And I read them, and I came back, and I thought, yes, he is, in many ways, it seems to me, a genius. And by that I mean, he has written certain books that no one else but Graham Greene could have written. Just as you can say also of Hemingway, there are certain stories of Hemingway that no one else could have written. The first page of Farewell to Arms, for example, seems to me, by Hemingway, utterly masterly. I would have thought that of our times, that Graham Greene is surely looked upon today as the grand old man of English letters, the master himself. And I think that half a dozen of his novels, I could mention them if you wanted me to, in my view, are truly great novels. And that if he writes nothing else, he will have earned the respect and esteem of future generations. They would be Heart of the Matter, Ministry of Fear, Burnt Out Case, Power and the Glory, absolutely and certainly. Maybe at a second level, novels about Haiti, like The Comedians, for example, and The Quiet American. But they are lesser breed novels, good though they are. I think unquestionably he is, by say, a man who is no longer his friend, but wrote brilliantly about this biography, famous man in England when it came out, Anthony Burgess, would be, speaking of English writers, the two men that I would cite as having written with such quality and such insight about this strange creature, man and woman, that he has to be, when all of us are dead and gone, when Don Swain no longer looks at me intently as he is doing at this moment, when Norman Sherry is under the sod, when Graham Greene has long since gone, unless he's going to live to 120 and write his biographer's obituary, then still the child born this night, in wanting to know about our so-called modern age, when he's grown up and become an adult of, say, some 20 summers on his head and has white hair, and wants to know this strange, even to him, Victorian times that we are now living in, then I think he'll have to go to Graham Greene, and he'll have to come to this biography, because it is indeed a passionate odyssey and pilgrimage in things that are fascinating about one of the truly great writers of our time.
Well, that was certainly an eloquent statement, Norman Sherry. You spent 10 years with this first volume, and the second volume has come out, and I'm almost embarrassed to tell you that when I started reading it, I really couldn't put it down. I read it, it's embarrassing to state that I read this within an 8-hour period. It's true that in some places I went fast, but I did read it in one sitting.
Don, I'm astonished. I love you for it. That's most incredible.
Well, what's astonishing is that this is not the kind of book that you really should read in an 8-hour period. This is enough. There is enough in here to read for weeks and weeks and weeks. But I spent the day on my day off reading. But the thing about it was I couldn't put it down. And I was also anxious to get to the part in Mexico because I knew that was coming up. And the photographs are fascinating. That's another nice thing, too, because not only are there family photographs, but there are photographs showing where he went and putting his times in perspective.
If, for example, you know, when he was in Liberia, I know this privately from Graham, he was in Liberia, and he met a famous Baptist missionary called Dr. Harley, a kind of Dr. Livingston, indeed, of the Baptist Church. Wonderful missionary. Spent his whole life out in Liberia, lived there and died there. And Graham Greene met him on track at the point in time when he was becoming quite sick. And he made a powerful impression on Greene, this man Haley. And as it were, Greene went out of his life. This was in 1934. And when I wrote the book about, I went to endless trouble to get photographs which would cover not only the journeys I'd made but the journeys Greene had made, and even the man he had met deep in the jungle, Dr. Harley, there's a photograph of him too. Finding the photographs themselves took years.
I guess it'll be a few more years before we get to volume two.
I hope not, Don. I'm passionately determined that I teach at a university in Texas, as you know.
How do you have time to teach and do this work?
Well, that's what I've had to do. I've burnt a lot of the midnight oil, but I think that hopefully, if only the book sells and I have enough royalties, I'll spend them on no longer working for 2 years, and so maybe I close the glorious life of Graham Greene, or if he's still with us, I can't really quite close it. Because the journey of a biographer is not like a novelist, say, dealing with the married life of a person or the pre-marriage period. The journey of a biographer is from womb to tomb, even to what is written on the tombstone. What will be written on Graham Greene's tombstone, I think, will certainly be just an immaculately short statement of his birth and his death. Born 20 minutes past 10 on the 2nd of October, 1904, and still running hard.
That's a marvelous piece of scholarship. Thank you, Norman Sherry.
Thank you, Don.